Okay.
You were chairman of the Department of Biology, but you then assumed the responsibility as provost for instruction in 1968, and mm-hmm. were in that position through 77.
Various title changes, but essentially that same position, right.
Was that to coordinate instruction? Would that be like dean of instruction now, or was that?
It would be more like vice president for academic affairs.
Oh, okay.
But with a man who had an interesting concept in how institutions should be organized. Jim Harlow, who came out of Oklahoma, felt that universities really needed a non-hierarchical structure. They needed as flat a structure as possible, so that you really saw, for all practical purposes, a president, a dean, a faculty member. That was the basic organization, series of organizational levels. And if you drew a chart like that, you'd have a very long list of deans out here and a president here. But Jim was also a good student of management and knew how modern organizations worked as well as how ancient organizations worked. He was strongly influenced by the developments after World War II in running gigantic, large-scale projects like NASA. A good friend of his was Jim Webb, who ran NASA as the first civilian administrator for the space agency for years, and took it away from the military in a very skillful set of negotiations that you want to read about someday. The German general staff was the model that was being looked at by many of the experimenters in management at the time. General Electric was looking at this approach. IBM had a little version of it. Harlow was experimenting with it in the university. The concept there was that there was only one commanding general, but that general couldn't possibly handle what was needed in order to run the army. He had to have very sophisticated staff work, and those staff people had to be highly defined and highly organized and carefully coordinated and working as the alter ego of the president. So instead of dividing the university up into a fiefdom for the vice president for administration and another fiefdom for the vice president of financial affairs and another fiefdom for the academic affairs, he said, we're going to run a team. The general staff is one model. The committee is another. General Electric developed a management team. And we ran a team, I think, of six people. The president, the vice president or the provost for instruction, the provost for research, the provost for extension, and he had a provost for financial and business affairs. So the six of us, I may have missed one, but at any rate, the six of us were involved in running that institution, three academic ones and a couple of business ones. And none of us had, at the beginning, any systematic line responsibility. The deans and the directors reported to us, not to me. They reported to the team as a whole. The result was that I learned how to get groups of people to make system decisions, university-wide decisions, without the regionalism and parochialism that normally attend that kind of friction. We modified it over the years. It had to be modified. And we changed names, and we eventually had line responsibilities. I ended up with 14 deans reporting to me, and all of the academic aspects of the institution, the Office of Admissions, and that sort of thing. Anything that was related to academics, to class instruction. But I didn't determine the budget there. The budget is very much the way I tried to put it together here. We had a budget and planning team. And in our case, our vice president for administration and I co-chaired it, so that we shared responsibility. we weren't in conflict, and one didn't report to the other. We also, as a matter of systematically influencing people's behavior, we shared the same office suite. We deliberately designed our arrangements so that we had a common secretarial pool, and we had a couple of offices opening off this pool, because we wanted to give the message to everybody that administration and academics were not in conflict. They were part of the same operation. And partly because of the training we'd had with Harlow, it worked very well. We knew how to work as a team. Now, I was not that successful here. Sherman never learned not to be vice president for finance. George West knew a great deal about how teams work and could work, but absent my control over how Sherman behaved, he had a very difficult time with Sherman. Now, Sherman had immense loyalty, and he knew what I was doing. He just couldn't change his patterns of behavior. And it's sort of interesting, because he came out of a military background where staff work and staff relationships were very clearly defined. But he saw that not as a team effort, but as a hierarchical effort of reporting to the commanding officer, rather than working with the commanding officer. And I have a tremendous respect for the way in which the military trains managers, and I think universities have benefited from that, both conceptually and actually from picking up some of these people, but I was not able to create the same working relationship here that I had with Ray Haas in my job in West Virginia, even though I worked at it. And I was able to do something interesting here, though, for a university system as opposed to a university. The problems of integration are a little bit different. I did manage to pull the chancellors in as part of that team, and on all but a couple of issues, they behave as a team of system vice presidents just as much as they behave as a collection of independent fighting chancellors. Now, the one thing that they can't do, they simply can't set priorities for capital projects. Literally can't do it, and so I don't ask them anymore. I do that. Mm-hmm. And they understand and accept it. They recognize it. They just can't do it. But on all kinds of things, they've grown out of themselves. The direct confrontation of one chancellor with the other in terms of playing some zero-sum game, that doesn't really exist anymore. And
one of the things that I remember you bringing from West Virginia was a real dedication to conscious planning and decision making. What was the planning environment like at West Virginia?
Well, Ray and I created it. It had been pretty much of a, I wouldn't say blue sky. Things were proposed that were proposed because they thought they'd be accepted rather than because they were necessarily needed. And the basic approach was of leverage. I've got to have this to match the federal grant. I've got to have this to match our commitment to the Department of Agriculture. I've got to have this to meet our accreditation requirements for the business or society or whatever. And that was the basic sales effort. There was very little effort made to say, I need this because I expect so many hundred students in this to take this program in the next 3 years, and I've got to build the faculty in this area because, you know, that kind of thing. We developed planning with a different concept than the previous planning in West Virginia. The previous planning had been what I called blue ribbon committee approaches, in which you take a set of wise men, or and they don't have to be wise men, but generally they are. You take the leading campus professor and a couple of other people and a staff, and you go off and you deliberate and you hold some hearings, and 6 months later, or a year later, you come up with a report on the future of West Virginia University. And this gets properly endorsed and properly criticized and properly bound and filed away, and it has very little impact on the future, except when somebody comes up and says, but look, in this 1946 planning report, the Department of Biology was supposed to have new quarters by such and such a time, or some such thing. But it seldom does a Blue Ribbon Committee have a major impact on what actually happens, with few rare exceptions. The Flexner Report did on medical education. There are some well-known contradictions to this, but that's generally happened when there's been a significant, serious problem, and then it's the solution to that problem that is accepted, rather than the Blue Ribbon process as a process. What we tried to do was to develop planning so that it was grassroots. That's the essence of a professional association, where the real competence, the authentic authority, really lies out there with the chemists, if you're talking about chemistry, and the historians. That it also had the legal responsibilities of the university carefully safeguarded, in that ruling on conflicting claims of chemistry and biology really was the responsibility of the Dean of Arts and Sciences, and that person's decision-making authority had to be reinforced too. So what we did, I guess, was to say, let's give the planners of the university, the people that actually operate the institution, the information they need and the process they need to get the necessary reviews and decisions made about what their plans, how their plans will come to fruition. So we created what we called our agreement on where we've been. We created a fact book. We beefed up the institutional research section, put out more and more statistics and analyses on student credit hours and unit costs and enrollment trends, graduation trends, that sort of thing, so that we had an agreed upon estimate of where we had been in the past. And then we worked very hard for a year or more trying to get agreement on goals and objectives for the university, for each school and college, for each department. And that was a matter of iteration that went up and down until finally we got them into some consonance, some consistency. Now, the University of Alaska really is in the middle of that. It's had a series of goal and objective settings, but the iteration process has been spotty at best. There's no necessary agreement. Geophysics has not yet agreed that its goals and objectives are but a subset of UAF, and UAF has certainly not fully agreed that its goals and objectives are but a subset of the statewide university. It's still in a process of flux and tension. But this is part of myth building, that you could sit down, you could, and I could, and you could, Bill, and we could write the goals and objectives for the university and impose them, but that would have little impact on behavior. It's only when you go through that iteration enough, and we've had such little background and little sophistication in that, that I'm not embarrassed, I'm just disappointed it didn't go farther. But it took us a good deal of time in West Virginia too. Now that gave us an agreed upon picture of where we wanted to go. We then did one thing more. We then developed, with a special committee that had the widest possible participation, staff too, classified staff, the whole range of people, what do we see in the future? What are our assumptions about the future? What do we see happening to federal funding in various areas? What is our best estimate of the state budget? What's going to happen to our enrollment? What's the quality of students? Piece by piece, we put a whole series of assumptions in 9 basic areas together and worked that through in an iteration process until we finally agreed that this is the shape of the future. It was our agreed upon shape of the future. Now, if you can give a manager some idea of where we've been in the past, some idea of where we're headed in the future, and a common set of goals and objectives, he's got all the tools he needs to plan properly and consistently. And it takes one other thing. If you're the CEO or the vice president, you have to behave as if that planning were important. So we produced the right sorts of forms so that the linkage with the goals and objectives had to be made explicitly, so that a piece of paper didn't just come in. We had to decide what goal and objective did that fit. And then for those people who had good planning, who had the documentation, who did their homework, whose proposals fit our agreed upon set of objectives for the future and so on, we did it. You know, we rewarded that. For people who just came in with nothing, we did nothing. And it took just 2 years. It just took two planning cycles until all of a sudden the quality of submission from the deans just escalated just like that. There was a quantum jump. It became organized and systematic. Instead of the game playing that you probably still see here, where a dean will come in with a request for $200,000, knowing that if he's lucky, he's going to get 100. Well, people began to come in for 100, and they got 100. And not 50. And so it wasn't necessary that you ask for twice as much as you have any chance of getting, hoping that they'll split the difference somewhere. We had neat little budget games in which people could have a number of hands. You know, there's a principle of budget making that says that in the long run you tend to distribute reasonably equally among all claimants. And sociologists tell us it's pretty close to being true. If you look at our university here, there have been some changes in percentages of the budget to various units of the campus here at UAF and to various units across the system, but not much. The consistency in sharing the resources, the even-handedness, is greater than the distinctions that are being made. And you can, well, you're going to find a department that got wiped out. You know, you're going to find something, some idiosyncratic peak or valley. But in general, well, this also means then if you as a librarian hold out two hands, one over here is an institute for information services, sciences, and another one over here for circulation services, you're going to get more money than if you hold out only one hand for the total library package, unless there's careful planning. Well, we forced the deans to fold all institutes, all centers and whatnot, into their college. No more freestanding institutes, no more institute for educational research, no more institute for business research. These were functions and activities of each dean. And if the dean chose to fund and organize in that fashion, that was up to the dean, but it was within his or her budget rather than as a separate competing unit for the budget. And what that did is to give the key middle management in the university some fantastic authority and responsibility. And in the end, that's what's going to develop the deans on this campus. If the level of authority over all the activities, instruction, research, and service, begin to be focused on that particular individual, responsibility and commensurate authority, that's when the institution is really going to start moving. Because as long as you have the institute of something or other out here moving independently and doesn't give a damn about this, the instructional program, I think in many ways that's part of what Pat is trying to do here at Fairbanks. To fold these things in so he has people who are responsible. It's what I've been trying to do with rural education, to get individuals in properly structured positions in the university responsible for what happens in rural Alaska, for all things, not just community college at Nome, but for what happens to the extension service, how agriculture relates, how business relates, how all these activities relate to the university's efforts in Nome, Alaska. And we'll get there. I'm leaving some good messages for our next president.
So the critical part in the planning process is not only articulation of the plan with the before and afterward vision, but also the implementation and the evaluation.
It's the process, yeah. Each decision has to be an informed decision. It has to be informed by the plan. And the plan then has to fit our assumptions about the future. It has to fit our goals and directions. It has to be consistent with what we did in the past.
Why do you think academics tend to be so adverse to the planning process, or is this a more human condition?
I'd say it's probably that. It's a more human condition. As long as you have a lot of political leverage, you might as well go the route that gives you the maximum payoff. I think there's a lot of not necessarily cynicism, but pragmatism there.
I also wonder whether it isn't an easier avenue in that if you don't plan, then you can continue to live with a so large a vision that you have almost endless possibilities, and you don't ever have to disappoint yourself by saying, I know I won't do this, and we have to focus. It forces you to pull your sights in.
Yeah, to set the goals may be very broad, but the objectives have to be quantifiable to be really useful. And that means highly specific and hence limited. And you're right, that could well be a piece of it.
It's a little bit of dream busting.
Yeah. But it's better to have a planning process like this that brings issues up in terms of goals and objectives every year, rather than have the old-fashioned blue ribbon approach that says the Department of Mathematics isn't important and it's going to be our lowest priority. That devastates morale, and I think that kind of blue ribbon priority setting is worse than the year by year effort of deans and vice presidents and presidents to manage competing competing priority demands without necessarily saying that you're at the bottom. It's just that this is higher this year because this is our objective this year.
How do you in the planning process get deans to see themselves less as competing entities than as perhaps a more Japanese management approach of being responsible for the whole?
Well, that was the effort I made with the chancellors here. And I think with a small group it's possible. With a large group of deans, I don't think it is possible. I think you can you can in the end do what we propose, that we want the process to be rational enough so that at the end of the allocation decision-making time, you understand why you got what you did. You may not agree, but at least you'll understand the process. It wasn't just because Dean so-and-so was married to the provost's daughter or something like that. There had to be some more rational explanation for it. That's worked.
Going back to your West Virginia experience and wrapping up, what do you see as the real challenge that called you into a much deeper involvement in administration rather than staying as chairman of the biology department?
I think perhaps it was Harlow. Usually it's people that move you. I haven't thought about that, but as you asked me, that's what comes to mind. We had a big battle. As chairman of biology, I was incensed over the fact that they were building a basketball theater or coliseum and dumping waste rocks and concrete down the arboretum, which was a departmental responsibility. And down in that arboretum, there was perhaps the biggest tree or the oldest tree in West Virginia. It was a chinkapin oak, an enormous and old, old tree. And I very deliberately started a little campaign of Save the Chinkapin. I had tried to get that dumping stopped through normal channels, and nothing happened. And so I went public with it. And Harlow called me and and said I just had a call that the whole Women's Garden Club of Charleston is going to march on the president's office if I don't save the chinkapin oak. He said, come on up to the office. And what he talked about was the fact that he wanted to implement his new approach to managing a university, this low-profile, non-hierarchical staff approach or committee approach. And he said, Jay, this is your total directive. He said, I want you to be that part of the president that worries about instruction. And that was my job description, to be the piece of the executive officer that worried about the instructional aspects of the university. And I think I was intrigued with the idea as much as anything else, and decided that was something I wanted to try. Perhaps a formal invitation to be a dean, I'm not sure I want to be a dean, or to be an administrator, maybe I never would have responded to that, because that really was a dramatic change. I was still a biologist. I was still reading biology. I was in biology. I felt that running a department was just a logical extension of my profession as a biologist. But Harlow didn't ask me to be an administrator. He didn't ask me to worry about courses in educational administration or to read books like that. He asked me to be that part of the president that worried about instruction. And I was his first appointment to that. And he made it some months after. And we joked later. He said, Jay, he said, it was partly the whole Chinkapin Oak that made me ask you. He used to tweak me about it in public meetings for years. I guess that's how it happened, more than anything else.
Why don't we stop there, and Okay. Perhaps we can pick up just your general perceptions and talk more specifically about the University of Hawaii.
All right. First reading.